Thank you, Brother Titus, for helping me out in those words of exhortation. Of course, all of that is possible because of Titus 2:11, which says, "For the grace of God that bringeth salvation hath appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, godly in this present world, looking for that blessed hope and the glorious appearing of the great God and our Savior Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us, that he may redeem us from all iniquity and purify unto himself a peculiar people, zealous of good works." And so those exhortations in chapter 2 are completely pursuable in the grace of God that's in Christ. And so praise the Lord for that. Let's turn back to James chapter 5. There's one example that I didn't get to this morning, as we looked at "be patient therefore" in James 5:7. We looked at the rich men and the four dangers of riches that can be applied to us today living in a very wealthy culture, although probably none of us are rich like these men were, but yet compared to the poor people in James, we are rich compared to their poverty. There was only rich man, poor man in that society, in most societies other than America itself and maybe a few others where there's a middle class. But in the Bible, when you read of rich and poor, that's all there was. There was no middle class. You were either on one extreme or the other. And so we can apply those principles to our own lives and the dangers of wealth. Somebody may say money is the root of all evil, but that's not what Paul said. He said the love of money is the root of all evil. And that's a colossal difference. Money is not evil. It's very necessary, but it's the love and the heart's covetousness for what we think money will ultimately give us, what it cannot do, is what makes that evil. It's our own hearts and our own lusts. And then we looked at "be patient like the farmer" and looked at a few examples of how a farmer is patient and expecting the harvest and the precious fruit. Then we looked at "be patient like the prophets" and considered Jeremiah and the fact that they spoke in the name of the Lord and what kept them enduring through the afflictions they endured and the sufferings they had to encounter, which all of them did. There were none of the prophets that were not persecuted in some way, and many were actually killed simply for delivering the message of God. And then lastly, we look at the patience of Job. "Be patient like Job," verse 11. "Behold, we count them happy which endure. Ye have heard of the patience of Job, and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy." Now, the word "very pitiful" is not used like a mother may use toward its little child when they're sick. How pitiful. It means extremely compassionate. Extremely compassionate and merciful. Now, what's striking about Job in this chapter that has rich men in it is that Job was a very rich man. Very rich. In fact, Job 1 says he was the greatest man in all the East. There was none like him in terms of wealth. He had 7,000 sheep. He had 3,000 camels. He had 500 oxen, 500 donkeys. He had a great household, which meant many servants beyond the 10 children that he had. And he was the greatest in all the East. And so here's a rich man that's of a different sort than the rich men that we see in James chapter 5. He was a rich man that was not in love with his wealth. He was in love with God, but nevertheless, he was rich. Now, it's at this very point that Satan is going to attack Job, because he poses the question to God and says, "Does Job serve God for naught? Does he serve you for nothing? You put a hedge about his family and his house. You're giving him all this wealth. I mean, what do you expect a man to do when you treat him like that? Anybody would serve you for that kind of wealth. You take away everything he owns, he'll curse you to your face." And that was the point where God said, "Okay, you can touch all that he has, but you cannot take his life." Job, or Satan rather, thinks that Job is much like other rich men who trust in their riches or in love with their riches, and therefore he's going to attack Job at that point and on that basis. And so we see, related to chapter 5, that Job was a stable man. He had a stable heart. If James says, be ye also patient, establish your hearts unto the coming of the Lord, for the coming of the Lord draweth nigh, Job was such a stable man. He was stable in heart. Now that means, when we think about James 5 and the rich men here and the rich man Job, we saw that the rich men here in James 5, they heaped up treasure for themselves, accumulated, amassed reserves. They did this, and Jesus used this wording and said that they were laying up treasures for themselves on the earth. And then James says that they lived in pleasure on the earth. Okay, so they were amassing wealth. Job had wealth, but these rich men amassed wealth and lived in pleasure on the earth because they saw that pleasure was connected with what you own. And of course, when you're thinking humanly, that would be true. If you can't see anything beyond the four corners of the earth, like a box, and you're in a box and that's all you can see, everything on the horizon, the fool's eyes are in the end of the earth because that's as far as he can see. It's like a flat box and that's all he can see. He can't see upward. If that's all we can see, if that's all a man can see, then he must accumulate what he can. Even if he's poor, he's going to try to accumulate because he knows to live in pleasure on the earth, you must have some wealth, something, or you just can't do it. Humanly speaking, naturally speaking. Well, Job is stable because at the end of the trial, we're going to learn that he doesn't live like that. He doesn't live like that. Now, we couldn't necessarily know it, how stable he is, until the attack came. And the attack on him is going to show the stability of his heart in relation to God. So Job, on the other hand, he has wealth, but rather than laying up treasure for himself, he's doing like Jesus said, he's laying up treasure in heaven, or he's rich toward God in Luke 12, similar context, or he has a stable heart, which means he's living for the pleasure of heaven while on earth, rather than living for the pleasure of earth on earth. There's a big difference. Now, with the latter, it doesn't mean that you cannot have any pleasure in earth and things that God gives you. But it means that we don't live in pleasure exclusively on the earth because we're living for the pleasure of heaven while here, which means heaven, or God himself, which is the pleasure of heaven, must be the superior treasure that we're laying up. Because Jesus concludes his words with, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Your treasure indicates the impulse of the heart, where the heart is, what the heart loves. Now, if you take away a man's treasure, you should be able to see by response how much he treasures what he loses. Now, that's not to say that there are no tears and that there's no pain. But his endurance, his patience will indicate the treasure of his soul. Because the aim of endurance is to display the worth of God while living on the earth. That's the aim of endurance. That's why we should want to endure, is so that we want to display in our losses, in our oppression, in our times of trouble, that God truly is the treasure of our hearts. And so how do we know that Job was really stable? Because of his response after the affliction came. So we're considering first the patience of Job. The patience of Job. So what happened? Job was attacked by Satan. He lost his sheep, his oxen, his camel, his servants. Some of the livestock was slaughtered by fire that came out of the sky. Some of them were stolen by Chaldeans and Sabians, and then some of his servants were killed. And then after that, his children died because the wind came and smote the four corners of the house they were dwelling in. They feasted often, and it killed them. And Job got all this information just one after the other. I presume that Satan left one servant alive every time because they came back and said, I only am alive to tell you this. And so comes one servant, gives the information. A second servant says, I'm the only one that's left alive in this whole scene. That's interesting, isn't it? Three times, only three servants were left alive because Satan presumably wanted those servants to deliver the message to Job so that he would curse God right to his face. But Job did something different. He worshiped. He worshiped. Worship is an indication of where your treasure really lies. Now, in his worship, he's not smiling at all. I can't prove to you, it doesn't say he did not smile, but the words of what he was doing would indicate he's not a smiling man in terms of an outward happiness that we may think about. He shaved all the hair off of his head, shaved his head, rent his mantle, a form of deep, deep sorrow that he experienced in Job chapter 1. And then he worshiped and said. So what he's about to say is going to be the worship of Job's heart. Now, you know, in the past we've said worship is the position of the heart in relation to God. That's what worship is. The Pharisees in Matthew 15, they were worshiping God vainly because their lips and their mouths were in the right location saying the right things. You know, in the synagogue, in the place of worship, in the temple, the place you need to be to worship, the location. And they were all right there. And the words were coming out saying God and all that they needed to say. But the heart, Jesus said, was far from God. So worship then, that is not vain, is a heart that is close to God. And so Job fell down after he rent his mantle and shaved his head, and he worshiped and said, "Naked came I into this world, naked shall I return thither." The first statement of his worship was a statement of complete contentment with God. He was content with God's providence. He was content with the God that he loved. Now, he wasn't happy about the loss. I'm sure if you'd ask him, he said, would you like to have your children back? Yes, I would like that. But he was content with God and with God's providence. Now, the reason we know that, as you'll remember in times past, we've compared this text, Job 1:21, with 1 Timothy 6, because Paul will make a similar statement that Job makes, different word, but we can see it's the same contextual statement, when Paul says, "For it is certain we brought nothing into this world, and we can't take anything out." Now, that's what Job said, right? Job said, "We came in naked." That's a way of saying, nothing. We didn't bring anything to this world. "And we'll return naked," Job says, meaning we'll take nothing with us. You can't take a thing with you. Men have tried. I know King Tut tried, but he's a goner. His stuff is still on display. You can go to some museum maybe in England or somewhere and see all his stuff. He left, the stuff stayed. And that's forever the way it is as human beings die. So Paul said, we can't take anything. We didn't bring anything with us. We can't take anything out with us. So having food and raiment, let us be satisfied. Let us be content with food and clothing. Now, when Job says that, he's worshiping by saying, "Naked came I into this world. Naked shall I return thither. I am satisfied with God." And that's worship. Worship is the satisfaction of the soul in God at all times. Now, that doesn't mean I worship all the time. You understand that, right? But that's what it is. And that's why it's such a fight to worship God, because our souls are seeking to be satisfied somewhere. When we lose sight of true worship and lose sight of God, we will find it, as these rich men did, in living in pleasure while on the earth. But Job was living in pleasure of heaven on the earth by using his wealth in a God-honoring way. If you read Job, you'll find chapters where Job, he's pondering his pain and his suffering with those miserable comforters. He would actually say, "When I saw a poor man, I helped him." Now, these rich men never did that, but Job did. He said, "Was there ever a person that came to me for help and I turned them away?" Never. Not a single person. And I think Job was genuine when he said that. Now, you got to be careful with Job, because even though everything in the Bible is true, some of the things that are said by the men are not true about God. It's a kind of a tricky book. Theologically, they are not accurate completely in what they're saying, because they have a wrong view of God, which says, like the devil, you know, if you serve God, things go well. And if you do sinful things, then this is what happens. And so they say, with that kind of mindset, Job, you've obviously done some sinful things, because this doesn't happen to people when they're serving God. And they were wrong theologically. And that's how we approach God naturally. We think, "God, I've done well, give me well. And if I do bad, I expect to get bad." And we find people doing well in the Bible that got bad, but it wasn't because they were doing bad. And so you have to understand that with Job. So, Job worships with a statement of contentment in God. That displays his stability. He is not a double-minded man, which means he's all outwardly pious and religious, which is what a double-minded man is, but inwardly his heart is in love with his riches. We know now when his riches were taken away, his family was taken away, his heart was resting, struggling with, and content with, and clinging to the God that he loved. In his pain and agony, he was hanging on to God. And in all this, Job did not sin nor charge God foolishly. The very thing that men often do, charge God foolishly when things go wrong in life. Where are you, God? And start charging God. He didn't charge God foolishly. Now, he didn't know about the conversation with the devil, but he simply takes his pain and his sorrow to the primary cause, God himself. God giveth and God taketh away. And that's the second statement of his worship. So he was content. I skipped over this one. The second statement of his worship, of his stability. We're looking at the patience of Job. His stability from a stable heart was, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Now, as you and I read the text, we say, wait a minute, Job, you got that wrong. The devil took away. Now, the devil may not have given it to you, I understand that, but the devil took it all away. No, Job does not find any peace in secondary causes, and you won't either. Secondary causes are as real as I'm standing before you. They are real, and they are part of God's plan. But the ultimate primary cause, whether it be purposeful permission or purposeful causation, God is the ultimate cause, and we take our peace, our rest, our struggling hearts to him. And we say, you gave all of this and you took it away. I heard a man one time that was trying to suggest that Job was being rebuked for saying that the Lord took it away, when it really wasn't the Lord that took it away. It was the devil who took it away. Well, true, the devil took it away, but God gave him the permission to do it. So it was purposeful permission to be taken away, which means God was the ultimate decisive one that determined it would be taken away, or he would have never touched Job or even gotten within a square mile of his house. Yet God says, you can touch him, but you can't touch his life. That is divine permission and sovereignty. I don't think the devil is the kind of person that just willingly does what God says. We can't read that about him in the Bible. But he knew he was not to touch Job's life. I don't think it wasn't because he didn't want to destroy Job. It's because he could not, because God would not suffer it to be. So he says, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And that's the kind of worship we need to engage in with a stable heart. Beloved, you may walk in here one Sunday morning blubbering like a child. Any one of us may be. You may be racked with pain. But the place, or even if it's not a place, the thing to do in such pain is worship your God. And it'll bring a peace to your soul when you're hurting badly in soul because of tragedies and difficulties and pain that's coming into your life. Worship. God deserves our worship, and we worship him because ultimately he is over it. If he's not over it, where do we go? If he's not the one in control of it, where is our peace? But he is. And so Job's stability, his patience, was revealed in the fact that his heart, his stable heart, then shows the pleasure of his soul while living on earth was not his riches. He used his riches. He owned those riches. They were his, given by God. But when they were taken away, his heart was fixed. His heart was strengthened. His heart was stable, resting in the God of the Bible. And so another thing we need to understand, not only was Job stable, which was the root of his patience, Job was patient. He wasn't sinless. Now, that's something to be pointed out. You read that Job was a perfect man, upright, one that is escheweth evil, he feared God, and that was true. But perfect there means he was a complete. He was one of the men that we talked about this morning that was growing in godliness in all areas of his life. As a husband, as a son, as it were, as a businessman, as a church member, he was growing in every aspect. There was no part of his life he just said, you know, I'm just not going to worry. I'm not going to worry about being a husband. I've got to be a businessman. He was complete and just growing. But he wasn't sinless. And if you read the book of Job, you'll see that very quickly. I say quickly, I mean time passed on, and Job's health was taken away. And it never tells us the time frame. You know, there's a lot of chapters there. We don't know if that was 6 months, 6 years. I presume it was probably some length of time. I don't know how long it was. You know, that's the real test, isn't it? Typically, initially, at the shock of such information, we cling to God and we throw ourselves upon God. But then as the days roll on, that's when it gets hard, isn't it? Now, I'm not speaking from experience in terms of what Job experienced. But after days go by, days and days, that's when the challenges really get hard. It's like when someone loses a loved one. The initial point of family gathering around and other believers and friends to strengthen, but then when all returns to normal, the days that ensue get really, really difficult. They became difficult for Job. He began to say some things that were not right in terms of his suffering. And of course, his miserable comforters they were no help to him in this process. They were making it, as the term signifies, miserable for him. The things they were saying and suggesting must have been extremely difficult. And so the days and the weeks and perhaps years with boils all over his body, from the head to the sole, that he took clay pieces of pot, broken pieces of clay, to scrape them, to the burning, the itching, just all over his body. I mean, that's difficult, I'm sure. I can't imagine what kind of pain that would have been. He just laid in ashes. Presumably the ashes rubbed on him sort of helped, like a medicinal purposes, to sort of ease the burning sensation as he scraped the boils on his body. And these men were presuming that, Job, confess your sin, it'll be over. You've done something terrible. You've either killed a man or done something so dark, because this would not happen to you if it weren't for some dark sin. And of course, we know that wasn't the case. It was simply because God had a conversation with the devil and said, you can take him. You can take him, but don't take his life. Now, Job was not sinless. So, patient endurance doesn't mean there is no sin. We need to understand that. And being preserved by faith, the doctrine of the preservation of the saints, does not mean there is no sin there. In fact, the closer you get to God, the more you see your sin. What it does mean, you're hanging on, you're clinging to the promises of the Bible. You're clinging to the promises of God. And so he reasons and he says wrong things, but he's still talking. And he wants to even have an actual conversation with God. He said, I could appear before the presence of God. And then finally God comes and begins to speak to him out of the whirlwind in ways that are majestic and authoritative and glorious. And then we see here in James that not only we heard of the patience of Job, and the reason we've heard about it is because God determined to write it for us for our example and learning and admonition. We see God's role in this whole thing in verse 11. You have heard of the patience of Job and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful, extremely compassionate, and of tender mercy. The end of God. I love that statement. You've seen the end of God. What is the end of God? Well, the word end literally means the point aimed at as a limit. As a limit. You have seen the limit of God, the aim, the very point at which God is aiming at. The goal of God, we could say. The point of God. So what we need to understand from Job's afflictions and his patience, his stability of heart, his worship, he is not sinless. He's patient, but he's not sinless. He's enduring, but he's not sinless. We need to see that God has an end in view in your oppression. He has a point and a limit for you. I don't care what your lot is today. I don't care what you're experiencing. I don't care what it is. God has an end in view with the trials and the challenges and the difficulties you may be facing this next week. The point aimed at. So we may ask the question, what was the point then of the conversation? If the end of God is the point at which he's aiming at, the point he's aiming as a limit, then what was the point of the conversation of the devil with God? Well, the point was for God to show himself merciful and compassionate? What was the point of the Sabians and the Chaldeans? What was the point of the fire coming out of the sky? What was the point of the loss of health and the boils all over the body? What was the point of those men coming and talking with Job and being such miserable comfort? They just stared at him for 7 days. Imagine someone coming and you're in the hospital and you feel like you're about to die, and they come, three men, one on each side at the foot of the bed, and stare at you for 3 days, or seven rather, and they don't say anything. You may say, bring me a pistol. I mean, you know, just watched him. What was the point of that? What was the point of this whole ordeal? The end of God in the whole ordeal. Now, the point of the devil is very clear. He made his point very valid. And the point of his destruction was an evil heart that just wanted to destroy. And the point of the Chaldeans and the Sabians from the secondary causes is what they were after. All that's true in terms of their evil hearts. But the point of God and the end of God in all of this was to display his extreme compassion and his tender mercy. Now, beloved, the very word mercy presupposes a fallen condition. You can't define mercy without a fallenness. It doesn't work. When you say the word mercy, you're thinking of someone that needs mercy, someone who is in a predicament. Even the word can mean that there's been a transgression, there's something that's happened there, that someone is in need of mercy. When the criminal in the courtroom cries out, Judge, just be merciful. That would make sense, except the guy is a criminal and he needs mercy. Mercy presupposes a fallen condition. And so when we go back even to Genesis in the beginning, God's end in view for purposely permitting the fall of Adam was to display mercy to a fallen race that happened because he allowed it to take place. And God was righteous in doing so because he let him do it with a purpose. And God's purpose is always holy and righteous and good. And so how then can God exalt his end, which is to display mercy, if there is no fall? He cannot. And that's why he suffered it to be. Suffered it. These are key words. Allowed, permitted, suffered. But yet with a permission. That means Adam was wholly accountable, and so was Eve. And that means in all our sin, we are completely and wholly accountable because we just do what comes out of our hearts. And God is not the source of that. But he let Adam fall because his aim was to display his mercy greatly in the crucifixion of Jesus. Is it no wonder that God is going to give the prophecy of the Messiah in Genesis 3:15 right after the fall, how gracious he is and merciful, to state to man right there in the beginning, look, this is my plan. You have fallen, you have sinned, but my purpose in it is the bruising of the heel of my son. And he's going to crush the head of the serpent. And in all that, the ultimate aim and end of God is going to be mercy. Mercy at the cross. Now, because of Jesus and because of that ultimate mercy, everything now that God is aiming at in your life, caveat, parenthesis here, parenthesis, this is the most fun part about preaching, when you get to say stuff like this. End of caveat, end of parenthesis, back on target. That because of Jesus, everything that God is doing, he's aiming at displaying his mercy to you. Even in your valleys, there is a mountaintop on the other side of the valley. He's aiming at displaying mercy. You've heard of the patience of Job, but you've seen the end of God. And what was the end in Job 42? Job said, I have heard of thee with the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Well, Job had seen God. Job knew God. Job worshipped God in Job 1:21. He worshipped. He said, and he worshipped. He loved God. He even said, I know that my Redeemer liveth. So why is he saying, now I see you? Because he sees something of the mercy of God that he had not seen before. And the whole pathway to that display was the endurance of Job. The endurance of Job. And so what James is telling us, beloved, at the end of your endurance, whether it's those short-term ways that God is even revealing more of his mercy today, or the ultimate end in view, is that God's end is he's going to display his mercy in such a wonderful way that the the wrath being displayed in the end time against the wicked will actually work to serve the complete joy of the saints. And you know that's the construction of Romans 9, 22 and 23, when he says, what if God, willing to show his power, wrath, and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fitted to destruction? He's enduring, he's long suffering with the vessels of wrath. They are fitted, they're being framed for destruction. And that, and in the original language it means, and in order that he might do this. In other words, this is working for this. He is being long-suffering for the vessels of wrath in order that he make known to you the fullness of the riches of his glory. So when we know something about the wrath of God as it's displayed on the wicked, it completes our vision of God and joy in him. So God is always working for your good and working to display his mercy, because there's no greater joy that God can give you by simply unveiling himself and letting you see him. Just to see him. Now, as I've said before, heaven will be more than that. There'll be people there and there'll be something going on. But that's the ultimate aim. That's the ultimate aim. And so when you think about the difficulties of the pathway in front of you, look at these three areas. Remember the farmer. It's the long haul. It's the long haul. It's worth it. It'll be worth it. You won't be ashamed. You won't be disappointed. Wait for the precious. Cultivate holiness. Cultivate what's coming little by little today. Okay? If godliness and holiness is the environment of heaven, why not do that today, little by little, what you're going to be? And you'll experience more of the joy of what heaven is about. Although in earnest, not fully, yet progressively is the aim. And then look at the prophets. They've spoken in the name of the Lord. They give us an example of suffering affliction and of patience. They spake God's name and God's message, and they were persecuted and hated for it because the name of God was like a flame within them. We take in God's name through the word. It should inflame us. It should embolden us. It should help us to endure. And then there's the patience of Job. Remember, he was not a perfect man in terms of without sin, but he was a patient man. He was patient. And he saw the end of God. And we will see the end of God. We will see that end too, beloved, in our trials and the ultimate end. Ephesians 2:7, I'll close with this. That in the ages to come, he, that is God, might show the exceeding riches of his kindness and his kindness is mercy. He might show or demonstrate the exceeding riches of his kindness and his grace to us in Jesus Christ. What that means is God is going to spend forever displaying the great wealth of kindness, or displaying his end. The end of God is to display his mercy. He's going to take all eternity showing you, unfolding just how deep and how unfathomable and how unsearchable that mercy is.